Montana Writers, a look at Montana literature from the 1920s to the present through the works of six major authors. This program is a presentation of KUFM and the University of Montana Center for Continuing Education and is available for credit through continuing education. And now, the host of Montana Writers, Bill Beavis.
I arrived in Montana 4 years ago from Massachusetts. The paper that day carried a speech by someone in Colorado, I think it might have been the governor of Colorado, calling for the West to secede from the Union. Why? Because, he said, the East was trying to exploit Western resources for Eastern needs and profit. Secede, the man said, and sell them oil at our price, not theirs. I thought, well, the West still has a little spirit to it. I walked up to the corner grocery to buy a loaf of bread. A bony old man with a horse face rang up 63 cents. 63 cents, I said. Gee, bread back east is 53. He looked at me. Better go back east to buy your bread then. Hello, I'm Bill Beavis, and I've stayed in Montana, and I love it. I'm an associate professor of American literature here at the University of Montana. And when continuing education came to me with the idea of doing a course over the radio, I suggested a course in Montana literature. I'm not an expert on Western literature. Many people in this community know a great deal more than I do. I am generally trained in the history of American culture and American writings. I'm then an outsider looking in. Someone has just come to Montana, reading the books many of you already know and love, taking a fresh look at it from the perspective of American literature. This course is English 479, Montana Writers, being offered on KUFM for credit if you wish to take it through continuing education. You can call 243-2900. That's 243-2900. We'll be reading six books. Three old ones, three new ones is the way I think of it. The first one will be Garcia's Tough Trip Through Paradise. The second one, A.B. Guthrie's The Big Sky. The third one, Dorothy Johnson, The Man Called Horse. Then after reading those books that are familiar to many Montanans in name, if not in fact, we'll be looking at three newer ones, very good books, Dick Hugo's poetry, The Lady in Kicking Horse Reservoir, Welch's novel, Winter in the Blood, and D. Marinus, A Lovely Monster. Exactly why I chose those books and how they relate to each other will become clear as we go through the course. But I do view the first three as what we might call classic Montana literature, dealing largely with the frontier, cowboys, Indians, trappers, mountain men, and dealing with the frontier in mythic ways. The second group of books, Hugo Welch and D. Marinus, as in the case of D. Marinus, do not deal with the frontier at all, or they don't deal with it just in terms of the old myths. Now, the East-West antagonism, which I encountered on my first day here, and which I sort of enjoyed since I'd spent some time in Vermont and the old man's attitude in the grocery store was familiar and fun to me, but that East-West antagonism has a long and valuable history in Montana, and in ways it lies behind much of our course, especially behind the first three books. In 1801, New Orleans was sold and from Spain to France, and the port of New Orleans was closed to commerce down the Mississippi from our Western settlers. Thomas Jefferson found out about this. It was actually sold in 1800. It was 1801 before he found out, and when he found out, he moved very quickly. He appointed James Monroe, special ambassador to the court of Napoleon, to try and persuade the French who had just acquired New Orleans to sell it. In 1803, he had succeeded, and he bought all of Louisiana, which at that time included most of Montana. Now, there weren't many votes on the Mississippi in 1801. Why did Jefferson react so strongly and so quickly to this closure of a port to Westerners? Well, one reason, is that back then, 178 years ago, Jefferson knew that Westerners didn't always have much love of the East, and he was concerned about keeping the country together. I quote from K. Ross Toole's excellent History of Montana, An Uncommon Land. He says the closing of New Orleans, quote, particularly concerned Jefferson because he knew, as few of his compatriots did, how tenuous the West's allegiance to the East was. The Union was only 12 years old, yet already the peculiar independence of the Westerners, the frontiersmen, had asserted itself. Their suspicion of the federal government was already abiding. End of quote. So talk of secession, or fear of it, or the possibility that Western interests were so different from Eastern interests that the East had better be careful, lest the West wonder just why it should stick around in this Union, that possibility goes way back in American history. It was not only behind Jefferson's reaction to the closure, but curiously enough was behind his sending out the expedition of Lewis and Clark, which every school child in Montana knows about, to explore this place and for the first time. As soon as it bought Louisiana, Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark on their way, not just to explore, but to make sure that that different place out west was bound to the East, with economic ties, with political ties, with social ties, as fast as possible. Now, unfortunately, the way that Lewis and Clark opened to the West was largely a way for Eastern and British and European capital to come out, invest in, and exploit Western territory. The history of Montana, as K. Ross Toole has pointed out, is largely a history of the colonialization of Montana by the East. Our history has been a history of boom and bust. The fur trade from 1806 to 1840, but who owned the big fur companies, and where were the furs going? Back to Europe, back to England. Where was the money going? To Boston and New York, to England. The gold rushes, 1860 to 1880. Where was all that mineral going? Back east, back to Europe. Where was the profit going? Back east, Boston, London, New York, Europe. What's happening still? Montanans don't own coal strip. The Anaconda Company has been sold off out of state interests. So in fact, that same possible conflict between West and East, the division of interest between West and East that Jefferson was so quick to see soon after the birth of our country, has remained in the West. The West has, as K. Ross Toole says, often been colonized, meaning that our resources are controlled and developed by outside interests for their own benefit, and we serve them. Both capital and products leave the area. Instead of products being shipped out, with capital coming in, both leave the area. A British man by the name of Schumacher has recently been preaching the very interesting thesis that this is a general tendency of industrial nations, that urban areas make colonies of their rural areas, and that's the way that the Industrial Revolution has tended to work in the settled world. Now, these are all good economic and political reasons for a division between East and West, but there are also good cultural reasons for divisions between East and West, and these, along with the political and economic factors, are very important to Western literature. Now, interestingly enough, at the very time that Jefferson was defending his flank from the West, meaning he represented vested Eastern interests, quick to show the Western frontiersmen that the government in Washington had their interests at heart, even as he was there acting the powerful Easterner, trying to reassure the West that the East would take care of him, at that very time, Jefferson was, culturally speaking, a frontiersman himself. And from the point of view of Europe and France, Jefferson, whom we think of as the suave, sophisticated, well-educated Virginian, was having to defend himself from French attacks on the rudeness, the barbarian qualities, the savagery of all of America. I quote here from a description of Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, an article by Walter Hesford in the English department here at the University of Montana. Very good article, not yet in print. And he's talking about Jefferson having to defend all of America, including his settled Virginia, against the European conception that culturally we're totally inferior. I quote now from Hesford. Jefferson takes the opportunity in this book to refute at great length the allegations of the respected French naturalists, the Count de Buffon, that America's nature and America's natives were inferior to Europe's. Jefferson, it seems, has to prove that America is a natural success in order to validate its claim for a significant standing in history. Jefferson's defense has three stages. I love this. He first offers proof that New World animals are at least as large as those of the Old World. He is especially proud to inform the reader that what seems to have been the largest mammal ever to stalk the earth, the mammoth, once flourished, indeed, Jefferson insists, still does flourish in America. He then refutes aspersions cast on the physical, moral, and intellectual capabilities of the Indian. The natives' generative faculties match European standards, he proves, and the native's vigor on the warpath or in the dance surpasses that of the white man. The native's moral senses also, asserts Jefferson, fully developed, and his powers of oratory indicate a superlative genius. Now, it's sort of delightful to think back then, while the Westerners were looking back at Thomas Jefferson and his government as already representative of smooth Eastern interests and Eastern culture, Jefferson, just by virtue of living in America, is so out of it from the point of view of Europe that he has to go to great lengths to prove that we have big animals and intelligent natives. What does all this mean? It means that, first of all of America began as the West. At one point, Long Island was the West. A little later, across the Hudson was the West. A little later, Kentucky. Then across the Mississippi. And now, to many Americans, Montana, Wyoming, that's the West and all that's left of the West, unless you throw in Alaska, which simply in its pattern of boom camp seems to be Western to most of the country. Well, what then does Western mean as Jefferson appeared Western to the French? It means that the value and the virtue and the cultural worth of the West was always in question. That the West was identified with something rude, crude, something barbarian and savage. It seems crazy, but it's true, that Jefferson was defending us even at the level of the quality of our wildlife. He had to argue that we had large animals. Europeans thought nothing valuable could possibly exist in this country. So then, Montanans, as one of the last parts of the mythic West in the American mind, which we are and should be, Americans then inherit this tradition of being under constant cultural suspicion. I don't have the article in front of me, but it's up on the walls of the English department just, I think, a week or two ago in the New York, Sunday Times Review of Books. A review of Leslie Fiedler's work said that perhaps Leslie Fiedler's, I don't remember the terms, but the exaggeration in his stance could be traced to his having spent too much time in places like Buffalo and Montana. He taught at the university in Buffalo and at the University of Montana for a long time. Exactly that sort of snide implication that nothing of cultural value could be going on to the West has been with us for a long time. Now, as a consequence of being under constant cultural attack, the Western U.S. responded as most people do, either by, first of all, feeling inferior, or, second of all, by defining itself in aggressive reaction as anti-East. Much of Western literature and much of the story, much of the cultural history of the West, then consists of either trying to be Eastern, which they saw as pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, or in being aggressively anti-Eastern. Now, that would be fine, except that the East had become identified in the Western mind, as well as in the Eastern mind, with art, craft, care, discipline, subtlety, consideration, thought. And it's sort of like throwing out the baby with the bath. If you decide you're going to define yourself as aggressively anti-Eastern and then concede to the East most of the virtues that underlie literature and art, then in fact you're in bad shape as a writer. Because what's left but to pander to their very expectations of crudeness, grossness, lack of discipline. Now let's talk for a minute about American literature between 1860 and 1900, and especially Western literature in that period, and especially Mark Twain, and see how the divisions between East and West and how the cultural defensiveness of the West worked out in practice. Now, up until the Civil War, 1860, American literature had largely been in the hands of what we might call an aristocracy and of what passed for an aristocracy in Boston. American literature before 1860 could almost be taught as Harvard literature, except for Melville's Whale Ship, which was his Yale and Harvard college. Certainly the writers, if not wealthy, were mainly of established families, and certainly they were well-educated. Even people like Emerson, who were not rich, were from generations of New England ministers and formed an intellectual elite. Now, after the Civil War, things changed radically. For the first time, the major writers in America were not people of old family, people of the highest education, people of considerable money. For the first time after the Civil War, we might call this the rise of lower or even lower middle class literature. And the rise of Western literature came at the same time. At the end of the Civil War, certain Western writers, Bret Hart, Mark Twain, the foremost, became popular. At the same time, even in the East, the writers who were coming up, William Dean Howells, had been born in the Midwest, in Ohio, rather than in Boston. And the writers of the period of 1860 to 1900 largely came from families that were not very wealthy, families that were not on the Eastern Seaboard, and many of the writers by 1900 had their earliest experience in journalism. Now, how does the West fit into this picture? Well, Mark Twain is, in a way, our first Western writer, the first famous Westerner to write, the first famous Westerner to write about Western materials. And sad to say, the story of Twain's life and of Twain's writing is not always a very happy one, and I feel that he did not overcome the defensiveness which he inherited as being a Westerner. Now, of course, from the first, Twain represented Western vigor, Western humor, Western vitality, roughness, crudeness. His first stories that became popular were stories of the mining camps and the California gold rush. Remember, he'd gone from the Midwest, where he grew up, out to Virginia City to be an editor on a mining camp newspaper. There he'd written funny feature stories about what went on in the Virginia City mining camps around Reno. And soon he was in San Francisco, the celebrated author of The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, his early story that hit the big time. Now, Mark Twain himself, when you look back on all his writings and on his later life, seems to have been culturally schizophrenic. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean he loved the West, Western equality, Western vitality, Western freedom. He loved the unconventional and the outrageous, and he loved, most importantly, common speech and Western speech. An example of that love of Western speech here, and I'm quoting from the notorious Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, the kind of sentence that they loved back East and they saw right away as being a wonderful contribution of the West to literature. And here it is, the narrator telling about the frog, Daniel Webster, who was the best jumping frog around. Quote, Why, I've seen him set Dana Webster down here on this floor. Dana Webster was the name of the frog, and sing out, "Flies, Dan'l, flies, and quicker than you could wink, it'd spring straight up and snake a fly off the counter there and flop down on the floor again as solid as a gob of mud and fall to scratching the hind side of his head with his hind foot as indifferent as if he hadn't had no idea he'd been doing any more than a frog might do." You never see a frog so modest and straightforward as he was, for all he was so gifted. Now that little sentence, perfect rhythms, beautiful use of alliteration, very well written by any standard of the craft, that sentence, using Western dialect and using a Western subject, was the kind of sentence for which Twain became famous. But the fact is that he also loved to turn to a sort of high British high-class dialect, and he wanted to be thought of often as a man who could speak with the best Britisher in the Britisher's own dialect. I quote you another sentence from the same story, though this is, in fact, a narrator at the end of the story, and I think he's being mocked for this dialect. The point is that in many places and during many phases of his life, Twain himself affected such a dialect and wanted to be known by it. Here's another quote. "But by your leave, I did not think that a continuation of the history of the enterprising vagabond Jim Smiley would be likely to afford me much information concerning the Reverend Leonidas W. Smiley, and so I started away." Now, that sort of stilted, high-class, highfalutin writing, though it's hard to believe, was actually affected by Twain often and taken seriously. And when push came to shove, our first Western writer, Mark Twain, known for his use of Western dialect, known for his use of Western materials, really wanted to become famous back east. He married an upstate New York girl, got himself a big house in upstate New York, relished having contacts in Boston and London, relished moving in the best circles, though at the same time, and this is why I call him a little bit schizophrenic, though I do not mean that term literally, just dramatically. I don't mean he had that mental condition. Throughout his life, then, as well as wishing to move in the best circles of Eastern and British culture, he also held on to that Western origin, and in those circles loved to offend, shock, outrage, drink too much, say the wrong thing at the wrong time. So Twain, throughout his life, is sort of a meeting of the East and West, and he exemplifies those real differences of style, of approach, that had come to characterize the two parts of the country and coexisted in Twain's own character and split his life often and his writings into a Western dialect and Eastern dialect. Now, why should this pose such a problem for Western literature? To put it as simply as possible, let's say that the aristocracy which existed in the Eastern, mainly around Boston, before the Civil War, okay, that aristocracy was identified with culture. And by default, the democracy that was identified with the West, where everyone was free and equal, came to be identified with no culture. And Twain, throughout his life, though he knew the strength of his language, and he knew the strength of his material, and he knew that a life out West was just as valuable as a life out East, always felt himself repeatedly, not always, I should say, but repeatedly felt himself culturally inferior because he was a Westerner. And so at the drop of a hat would abandon his terrific command of Western dialect to imitate a standard British English dialect that did not suit him at all. So there's always been that need in the West to defend the value of its culture. Perhaps one of the best summaries of American contempt for the West and the Western spirit is in Vernon Lewis Parrington's historical book on the beginnings of critical realism in America, 1860 to 1920. Now, Parrington was not always an Easterner, and at the time he wrote this book, he was a professor at the University of Washington at Seattle in 1929. he considered himself a Westerner at that time, and yet he unleashed one of the most comprehensive attacks on the frontier spirit that's been penned. I'll read you about 8 lines from his historical work summarizing America, the period 1860 to 1900. Quote, "In the meanwhile, 1860 to 1900, America would be little more than a welter of crude energy, a raw, unlovely society where the strife of competition with its prodigal waste testified to the shortcomings of an age in process of transition. The spirit of the frontier was to flare up in a huge buccaneering orgy, having swept across the continent to the Pacific coast like a visitation of locusts. The frontier spirit turned back upon its course to conquer the East, infecting the new industrialism with a crude individualism, fouling the halls of Congress, despoiling the public domain, and indulging in a huge national barbecue." To summarize, then, in the minds of our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, in the minds of people who lived in the East and in the West around, say, 1880 to 1900, which is really when this course begins, the East represented culture, art, sophistication, and by several analogies, therefore, it equaled subtlety or complexity of thought or feeling, which is a silly thing for any people to give up, yield to another region. The West, in popular mythology, represented raw life, the basics, the fundamentals, the frontier. Now, in terms of cultural history, I just want to say, since I presented all this material, that I think that's all hogwash. It's hogwash because it depends entirely upon a materialistic definition of culture. It depends upon the idea that culture is a bunch of things to be imitated, to be brought out from one place to another. That culture consists only of, say, classical ballet or a certain form of music. That culture is not the expression of a human consciousness at a certain time or place, but a bunch of forms which somebody else has done, and if you don't do, you aren't cultured. Now, I disagree entirely with such a materialistic conception of culture, and because I locate culture as the expression of consciousness, then I might expect, or anyone with that view might expect, that Western consciousness, as soon as it saw itself in its own light and on standing on its own legs, not as non-Eastern, would be as interesting as any other consciousness and could be beautifully and profoundly expressed. I think that's finally happened, and we're getting close now to the real reason for this course. I think the first 3 books in this course still spring from a time and from authors, and I say this with all respect to them, when writing was still really looking towards the East for its style and its heritage, even though it might be dealing with Western materials. But that during the tremendous explosion of writing in Montana in the last 10 years, exemplified by the second, by the last 3 books in the course, the second half of the course, I think Western writing and Montana writing has really come into its own, has found an indigenous style to express an indigenous consciousness, and that's quite a different matter from an old standard English dealing with cowboy and Indian Western materials. Now, I've painted a rather bleak picture of Western writing up to this point, but I don't want to leave it at that. Not all writers have been colonized, as in a sense Twain was, carried back east and appropriated to their own purposes. Not necessarily. There are a number of advantages that Western writers have had from the first, and that writers like Twain capitalized on. The first advantage is the vernacular style. Now, of course, slang, vulgarity. Remember that Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn was banned in the library in Concord, Massachusetts, the home of Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne. Slang, vulgarity, etc., are always looked down upon by some groups as being outside the pale of literature and of art. But in fact, if you look at the history of literature, you find that some of the most important writers and some of the most important movements have depended upon an aggressive return to or assertion of common language. Dante was famous for writing in Italian instead of Latin. Shakespeare, with his vigorous and coarse street language. Wordsworth and Coleridge in the 1800s, returning to the speech of peasants, returning to the speech of the land, away from a literary dialect. So the ability of the Westerner, with his democratic spirit, raised on the frontier and a place where, as Jefferson believed, all men were equal. In fact, all men were equal, especially all men with a little bit of courage, a little bit of ability to stand the cold, some muscle and a gun. That equality was first realized on the frontier, though in fact it was imagined first back east. Out on the frontier, then, it was very easy to see common speech, the speech that everyone shared, as being a proper basis for good literature. And as I say, that has been a condition of many of the most important literary revolutions and the ones we look back on as representing high literature. A second reason that the West has had some advantage. The West in our time, and Montana right now, represents the American spirit. And by that I mean, as I've said earlier in the program, all of America was seen by Europe as the West. Long Island was the West when the sailors first landed. Jefferson's Virginia was the West to France. So that what Western writers have now is a heritage surrounding them daily that is the heritage that once was all of America. To illustrate how true that is, I'm going to read you a quotation from very early American literature piece. This is from Sewall in 1698, and it's a description of Plum Island off the New England coast. And this description, in asserting local town names, in asserting a vernacular, a local vocabulary and place names, and in asserting the beauty and vastness of the land around him, is nearly identical to the spirit that moves Montanans right now in a love of their land, and it can be seen as the original American spirit in the relation of Americans to their wilderness. Here's the quotation, 1698, Colonial Literature. It's on Plum Island, his favorite spot. As long as Plum Island shall faithfully keep the commanded post, notwithstanding all the hectoring words and hard blows of the proud and boisterous ocean, as long as any salmon or sturgeon shall swim in the streams of Merrimack, or any perch or pickerel in Crane Pond, as long as the sea fowl shall know the time of their coming and not neglect seasonably to visit the places of their acquaintance, as long as any cattle shall be fed with the grass growing in the meadows, which do humbly bow down themselves before Turkey Hill, as long as any sheep shall walk upon Old Town Hills, and shall from thence pleasantly look down upon the River Parker, and the fruitful marshes lying beneath, as long as any free and harmless dove shall find a white oak, or other tree within the township to perch or feed or build a careless nest upon, and shall voluntarily present themselves to perform the office of gleaners after barley harvest, as long as nature shall not grow old and dote, but shall constantly remember to give the rows of Indian corn their education by pairs, so long shall Christians be born there, and being first made meat, shall from thence be translated to be made partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light. So present-day Westerners inherit a very old and fundamental American dream that the human spirit will be reborn in the wilderness. That's what Sewall's talking about. And his vision of it is couched mainly in terms of landscape, animals, birds, the physical environment, which is beautiful and powerful to him. Certainly, since Western writers have inherited that tradition and that landscape, they have a strength as American writers that gives them considerable advantage. That strength, then, is the strength of the land, and by the time we finish this course, I'll try to claim that at least in the work of Hugo and Welch, rather than works being just about the land, set in the land, I think the strength of the particular Western landscape, not Plum Island, not Virginia, but our particular Montana landscape, has entered the writings at the level of style and consciousness, and really has begun to shape a literature of its own time and place. You see, then, there are a number of issues before us in taking up Montana literature. There are a number of questions we want to ask about Montana literature or Northwest literature or Western literature in general. First of all, of course, we always want to ask, is it good? Did we enjoy it? If so, why? Did we enjoy it more or less than other books? How valuable is it to us? But we don't want to ask only, is it good? We're curious about whether it's good on an Eastern model, or is it good because it expresses its own time and place? Is this Western literature, this Montana literature we're about to read, good because it has a voice of its own, neither an alternative to the East nor defensive, but genuinely independent? To go back to Toole's thesis, is this a colonial Eastern literature set out West, or is it a genuinely independent and fresh Western literature? So the question, is there a Northwest literature with which I hope this course will end, is really a question about the nature of literature in a region or a regional literature. And I want to say at the outset of this course, let's make no mistake about this, these are interesting and strange issues and complex issues, and I want to make a very clear definition of this, though the definition may well be arguable. And that is that a true literary movement in a region is a state of mind. That is, I'm not interested in regional literature if it only happens to include cowboys and Indians, or if the author happens to be living in Montana. If New York writers prefer to write in summer houses in Vermont, we don't call their products Vermont literature. If by Montana literature we mean only that it deals with cowboys and Indians, then to me it's not an important distinction and it's not an important question, and I wouldn't be teaching a course on it. Rather, what I want to know is, do we have a regional literature that's become the voice of a certain time and place? Is it the literature of a certain state of mind? And therefore, do we call it Northwest literature because it has a style and a consciousness that's characteristic of the Northwest? You can see then why these issues go beyond just setting. So then, we approach Montana literature wanting to know if it's come into its own, if it has broken its ties with previous places, is it now expressing an indigenous consciousness and expressing it in a way that owes, well, literary tradition always owes much to its forebears, but has it found its own voice in an original way? Let's turn now to the first book in the course, Andrew Garcia's Tough Trip Through Paradise, and you'll see why I've stressed the history of America and the history of the West and Montana so much in this introduction, because we really begin first with an historical book. Andrew Garcia was born of Spanish-American descent on the Rio Grande around 1853. He came up to Montana about 1876, followed some soldiers around for a while, for about a year, fell in with an old trapper, Beaver Tom, went trapping with him. While he was trapping with him, met some unsavory characters, whom you'll see in the book, left Beaver Tom and became an Indian trader, all this in the mussel shell country in the middle of Montana in 1876, 77, 78. The book really accounts about a year and a half of his life, from the time that he began trading with the Indians through the time that he marries a Nez Perce squaw, a girl who escaped from the Battle of the Big Hole with Chief Joseph. And the account takes him through the year of trading with the Indians and through a trip with his wife back towards her home country and back through the Big Hole, and then ends with her being killed by Blackfeet. Now, Andrew Garcia, the author, lived on in Montana, died about 1943, and he began writing down reminiscences of these experiences in 1920. So what we're first faced with is a rather complex situation that I wanted to review for you clearly before you begin it. We have a book written between 1920 and 1943 about events in 1878 in Montana. Garcia was living on a ranch near Alberton, near Missoula, Montana, when he wrote the book. The manuscript was found and edited by Ben Stein, who lives in Wilsaw, Montana, whom I'll be talking with during the course. The book obviously has claims to being an historical document because it's a first-person account of event of the life of an Indian trader for a year. It also has claims to being a novel because, let's face it, if you sit down to remember things that happened 40 years before, you're bound to invent the conversations a little bit. So we have here, we begin with something like a documentary history of 1 year in Montana in the form of reminiscences of an aging ex-Indian trader, Andrew Garcia. Now, how do these factors that I've been discussing enter into Garcia's work? Well, they come into it right away, surprisingly enough. Is he conscious of the East? Is he consciousness of the Eastern publishing industry as a Western writer? Sure enough, even this fellow who was only a Spanish trader up who'd never been back East, remember, he's from the Rio Grande, he came up to Montana, he's writing up there. I quote from page 35 of this book, when he's telling of an incident in which he was stuck with a bad man and probably should have shot him because he knew the guy would shoot him at the first opportunity. And here's what Garcia says about the incident. What Red said was so. When Labrie got the chance, he would have shot me in the back if he had to, but I had not the heart to do it that way. This killing business may seem easy to do on paper, but no one whose heart is any good wants to stain his hands with human blood if it can be avoided. I know that according to Blood and Thunder writers who write from a deranged brain back East and manufacture such stuff, that I ought to have pulled my gun at the start, and at the crack of both our guns, the villain Labrie would lay dead on the ground. Well, curiously enough, in that little paragraph, what Garcia is really saying is that already by the time he's writing, and we don't know just when that paragraph was written, let's say 1925, writing about material in 1878, Western material has already been colonized. The idea of the Western gunman, the idea of open gun battles, the idea of pulling out a gun and plugging somebody has been carted back East to be written up by Eastern writers. They've appropriated the material to their own use. And here's what the one authentic trapper we have in our whole course says about it, remember? I know that, this is what I just quoted, I know that according to Blood and Thunder writers who write from a deranged brain back East and manufacture such stuff, that I ought to have pulled my gun at the start. Well, after all the generalizations I've been giving you, there's nothing like an example, because they always pull you up short and mess you up in some way. And so there, our first example from a text. There's a Western, an Indian trader, identifying violence and bloodshed and irresponsible gunslinging with Eastern writers and saying he didn't hold any truck with that stuff himself. What about other ways in which even this book seems a part of Western literature and the tradition of Western literature? Well, as you read it, you'll be confused by some shifts in style. They are identical to Twain's shift in style. Just as I said, Twain would slide from a delightful Western vernacular to a kind of strangely stilted Eastern or even British English that was out of place in his mouth and out of place in his material, so also Andrew Garcia, when he fancies himself a writer and becomes self-conscious about his writing, abandons his natural Western dialect and writes absurd sentences such as the following one. Quote, speaking of a woman, an Indian squaw, "This Amazonian prairie Juno went under the poetical and soul-stirring nom de plume of Leatherbelly." Now, of course, he's trying to be a little bit funny there, but there are a number of other passages, especially on women, where he seems to be a little bit embarrassed or ill at ease with the material. When he is, he slides into this polyglot English that he considers some kind of high literary style. And of course, it's got a Greek allusion, Amazonian prairie Juno, South American allusion, Amazonian, French word, nom de plume. And this is his idea of high style. And as I say, it doesn't become him at all, and it did not become Twain. Now, the first book in this course, Garcia's Tough Trip Through Paradise, is not only a little bit odd because of its composition history, and because, in fact, it wasn't published during his life. It was found by Ben Stein in dynamite packing crates in manuscript form. And Ben will be telling us that story later in the show of finding the manuscript. It's not only strange because it's a reminiscence by an old trapper of first-person events, it's also strange because, really, Garcia, and I think the book is wonderful, let me say that right away, it's wonderful, but Garcia's not in control of his technique. Now, that doesn't mean his technique's bad, or he doesn't know what he's writing about. I mean that stylistically and in point of view, he's not quite in control of it. Nothing produces a stranger effect than a book that has some kind of inconsistency of technique. Now, let me make myself clear on this point, because you all will be, if you have not read Garcia already, you'll be leaping into it in the following week, and we'll be discussing it Tuesday and Thursday of next week. But you'll find something a little bit odd. You can't quite figure where Garcia's coming from. For instance, he's narrating his adventures as an innocent young man with squaw women, and he's kind of embarrassed about the point. But he doesn't seem to have the perspective of an old man who knows what embarrassment was when he was young and offers you a perspective on youthful embarrassment. He seems embarrassed as he's writing it. And you wonder, you know, did the guy learn anything in the 40 years or not? Now, there's a big difference between a book that is made to be strange and in which the strangeness is controlled by the author, and you can sense there's a sort of compact or agreement between you as reader and the author. Poe writes strange stories, but you know that they're controlled and that the feeling of strangeness you're getting is exactly the feeling of strangeness which the author meant for you to get, that he was controlling the strangeness. This book does not seem to be such a work. Instead, the atmosphere, the weirdness, the strangeness often seems to be sort of whimsical and changing, transitory. The techniques are various and uncontrolled. We'll have to be talking about that Tuesday and Thursday of next week, talking about specific instances in the book and the character of Garcia especially. But what interests me, first of all, is that we begin with one of the great Western myths of something barbarian, savage, and uncultured, the mountain man, the Indian trader. Yet it's written up, it turns out that this trader's voice is very sensitive, quite various, quite delicate, quite interesting, belies some of the myths. And we'll be discussing this book by means of a number of excellent commentators. Because the history in this book is so important, I wanted to approach it, first of all, from an historical point of view. That's why, for our first panel next Tuesday, I've invited K. Ross Toole, professor of history at the University of Montana and the author of several books of history, very good writer, to talk to us about Garcia. And I've also invited Ed Gallagher, who's done historical work for the fort here in Missoula, for Fort Missoula, who's done a number of historical jobs for various agencies around the state, who knows a great deal of Montana history, who's grown up here also. They'll be here discussing Garcia, and they both like the book very much and like Stein's editing job. They'll be discussing the book, and I'll be asking them, is it true? Because let's face it, I can say what I wish about Garcia's work as a novel, and considered as a novel, Garcia could do anything he wished. It's also true that when a man purports to write a first-person account of experiences that are very much in our history and in our mythology, he must be held to account historically also. What were the Indians like in 1880? It matters now. It matters right now in white conceptions of Indians and Indian conception of whites. What was Garcia like? How accurate is the book? So we'll begin next Tuesday by looking into the accuracy of the book and discussing it as history with those panelists. Then Thursday of next week, I'll be talking to Ben Stein, the editor of it. We'll get the story of finding the manuscripts, of editing them, and he'll be able to answer some of the questions that the panels raise. Then I'll be talking next week, in regards to this first book, about documents in literature, the relationship of documentary literature to novels. Well, goodness, how the time flies when you're having fun. You'll be happy to know that this is the last time you'll have to listen to a 45-minute lecture by me in this course. We'll begin on Garcia Tuesday, and remember, we'll be doing six books: Garcia, Guthrie, Johnson, Hugo, Welch, DeMarinis. On each book, we'll have a panel Tuesday discussing largely the background of the work, and the author or editor on Thursday discussing the work itself. My lectures will be a good deal shorter, thank goodness. I couldn't keep this up. Books are available at the Associated Students Bookstore at the University of Montana here in Missoula. Drop me a line, Bill Beavis, B-E-V-I-S, at KUFM if you have any objections or questions. Be delighted to hear from you. So we'll be on the air every Tuesday and Thursday at 9:30. The first three books, Garcia, Guthrie, and Johnson, will deal with a good deal, both with Western dialect and the Western myth of the mountain man and cowboy, so we'll be talking about this material a good deal. Well, this was pretty heavy, and they're waving hands in the control booth, so I better be off. As Garcia said, after one of Beaver Tom's delightful breakfasts of half-raw elk and coffee that would float an iron wedge, we were soon packed up. See you Tuesday.
Montana Writers is a production of KUFM and the University of Montana Center for Continuing Education. This program was produced by Bill Beavis and Greg McDonald and recorded in the Missoula studios of KUFM.